Я не самый бедный человек, я работал до этого в бизнесе 10 лет.
Кварталом выхода из рецессии будет третий квартал. Сегодня у нас уже
возможен другой суверенитет. Что можно быть...
От зоны США и евро, где инфляция будет
я
почти...
Я считаю, честно говоря, и Путина человеком, который был послан судьбой и Господом.
There is different as night and day. One's a geeky and cerebral economist with a talent for crunching numbers and balancing budgets, even amid mind-bending corruption. The other, a suave, flamboyant political operator whose hidden hand was behind much of the political intrigue over the past decade. Both were key players during Vladimir Putin's first stint in the Kremlin, and each played a major role in making it look successful. Both had strained relations with Putin's Siloviki allies. Both, in their own way, went off the reservation. And both Alexei Kudrin and Vladislav Surikov were back in the news this week. Amid mounting speculation in the Russian media that Putin was going to name him prime minister, Kudrin gave two speeches slamming the government's economic policies and calling for more pluralism in the political system. And a week after his resignation from government, Surikov popped up in a rather odd way. Photos posted on the internet showed him fishing with Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov, who went on to praise Surikov. Those photos surfaced days before press reports claimed Surikov was in the investigative committee's crosshairs in connection with an embezzlement case at the Skolkovo Scientific Center. As different as they are, Surikov and Kudrin are on the same side in a struggle that has been raging in the Russian elite, pitching technocratic managers like themselves who want reform and Siloviki shareholders fighting hard to maintain the status quo. And their appearance in the news this week is the latest evidence that this battle is heating up. Who has the upper hand? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague, performing without the assistance of a Skype line, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome to town, Mark, and it's good to see you in person.
Good to be here, jet lag and all.
joining us on the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
Nice to be with you guys.
Ever since Kudrin made that surprise appearance during Putin's live call-in program last month, the speculation's been mounting about his return to politics, and specifically as prime minister, which would probably be a signal that Russia was radically changing course or that Kudrin had shamelessly sold out. The speculation climaxed this week and was followed by Kudrin saying it wasn't happening, at least until the political situation changed. The Surikov story also developed this week with reports that not only might he be prosecuted, but that authorities are alleging that he was funneling money to the opposition. If true, this would be a major escalation. The Kremlin would not only be going after the opposition, but also after alleged collaborators among those who were once in Putin's inner circle. Mark, let's start with you and let's start with Surikov, I guess. Is the deep state about to start devouring its own?
Well, look, deep states are always carnivorous creatures.
They sure are.
It's not at all unusual for them to turn on their members. That's in part how deep states change and evolve. It's not as if they can continually add new places and new people because there's only a limited amount of resources to share out. So basically, it's about eliminating some to allow others in. But what I would say is that when we've seen purges of the similar order in the deep state, it actually tends to mean something quite significant. Firstly, that the deep state is under pressure, that there is a need for some kind of redefinition. Secondly, that there is a shift in the nature of who is in charge. I mean, if we think of the last really big purge of the deep state, it's people who we now think of as the complete outsiders, the Berezovskis, the Khodorkovskis, or on a lesser scale, people like Yeltsin's security chief, Alexander Korshakov.
Kasyanov.
Indeed. I mean, all of these people at one point were the absolute consummate insiders. and now we know what happened to them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's no surprise that people get eliminated. But the point is, that represented a truly sort of tectonic shift within the deep state. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, it's a question of, well, what's going on now? And I think with Surkov, whether he actually is charged with criminal charges or not, we don't know. The very fact that they're being talked about says something about the nature of this current sort of bloodletting. And I think in some ways what this represents is not the rise of a new elite, it's actually the reimposition of an old elite's power, that they for a while were willing to allow the managers free rein. But now when they feel under pressure, the Silovik / hydrocarbon sort of elite are now feeling, well,
the shareholders.
Yeah, precisely. You know, it's time now to sort of basically grab power once again with our own hands.
So they're showing, it's basically the Siloviki are showing the managers who's boss right now?
Yeah, I think because Surkov was always a very interesting, I know he's your main passion within the Kremlinology.
He's my main passion within Kremlinology.
Yeah, exactly. he was always an interesting case because, I mean, on one level, he was the consummate manager. But precisely because of the extent to which he interlinked so many other different power factors and power bases, he was much, much more than that. He was more than just the sort of the Chamberlain. And I think that's another reason why he has to be eliminated, because precisely he blurs those boundaries between the sort of those who are meant to just simply be the efficient administrators and those who actually own the state in that respect. And finally, I mean, you know, we don't really know exactly the nature of Surkov's departure. I think to a considerable extent he jumped, realizing that otherwise he was going to be pushed. And that makes him dangerous from their point of view.
Yeah, and there was even some interesting speculation in the press this week about his trip to London, which it was like saying, go to London and stay there. And he came back. I don't know how true that is. That was speculation. It wasn't even very well-sourced speculation. Although I will say the Gazette-Ru piece that spelled out this case that he is going to be prosecuted, I read it first just as a Kremlin wonk picking up speculation in the Russian press, but I decided to give it a second look like an editor. Like, how good was the sourcing? And the sourcing was quite good. It wasn't just your typical Kremlin sources spilling something to a journalist, which is a lot of what you get in the Russian press. It also was citing people from Skolkovo who had been interrogated and who said all they were interested in talking about was Surkov's control of financial flows, of money distribution, which tells me, I mean, they have no reason to lie, right? And which tells me there is a there. Now, whether this is going to come, and Mark, you wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, no, I just want to say, I mean, I think you've really hit on one of the key things about Surkov, is that he precisely controlled financial flows. In some ways, he was the equivalent of the butler in the country mansion, who also was skimming a large amount of money out of the household finances. And that's why he was in this sort of blurred position. He was more, essentially, you know, to go back to the old proverb, you know, he stole more than he was entitled to. Mm.
Well, in this sense, and you know, the funny thing about these allegations, they seem plausible to me because this does make sense. We know that when Surkov, in his role in the Kremlin, one of his jobs was to co-opt the opposition, right? So even if he was doing what he was supposed to be doing, right, he was, this could be now be something that's incriminating, which would also fit with the style. Sean, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I'd like to look at Surkov and his removal or resigning in a wider sense of what's been going on, and particularly Medvedev's cabinet being attacked over the last couple of months. I mean, here not only is Surkov been a target, but Arkady Dvorakovich has been a target. Medvedev's press spokeswoman Natalia Timokova has been a target. And if criminal charges are filed against Surkov, this definitely is raising it to another level, because this is somebody within, it's a two-pronged thing. One, Surkov was by all intents and purposes, the third most powerful person most important person within the government when he was running the ideology. So this is a hit against a big, big insider. But also Surkov is part of Medvedev's government, and putting one of them on the dock really is an escalation. And it's clear, and this has been repeated often in Russian press, that Medvedev is under attack, and he's under attack by kind of burrowing out the people around him. Yeah. One other thing I think needs to be considered is what. Now, we don't usually give a lot of stock to institutions, but one institutional struggle that's going on is that power has firmly moved into the presidential administration. The White House is no longer a pillar of power, one of the two pillars of power, and I think the attacks on Medvedev's government has that result of putting, reestablishing Putin's power vertical in the Kremlin.
No, and you had, I'll have to say, you had a very insightful blog on this that went up, either went up late last night or early this morning. I saw it this morning, and we had an interesting email exchange along these lines yesterday. Kirill, you want to jump in here? You have something to add?
I think there are two different problems. They are connected with each other, but they're different in themselves. First of all, what's going on or what's happening inside the power, inside, you know, the elite, inside Kremlin? It's very interesting the mentioning by Mark about the limited resources or human resources in the elite or inside Kremlin. It's not a total purge, like I agree, totally agree, was in the beginning of 2000s. It's not the times of, you know, Berezovsky, Khodorkovsky and so on, when Putin got rid of all of them. He's trying to rearrange the figures of his circle. But the problem is that this first purge in the beginning of 2000s was, you know, in the situation or in the context of two types of unlimited resources. Unlimited resource, human resources, a lot of people around whom he could use and used eventually. And secondly, unlimited resources of the country, financial and so on. I'd like to draw your attention to an interview with Gleb Pavlovsky and his article in Politru, on the web portal Politru, you know, several days ago. It seems to me that he listened thoroughly to our podcast because he just repeated several things we told about.
Which is good, because I retentively usually read everything Pavlovsky writes, although I missed this piece.
Yes, so he must be polite, yes, in this sense. So he told a lot of interesting things, and maybe we'll, you know, return to this interview and to this article, to different texts. But what did he say? He said that in the beginning of 2000, there were no any aim or urge or need to fight with opposition, especially in the regions, because governors and so on just could buy oppositional leaders there. Mm-hmm. Not the opposition leaders like now, like, you know, Udaltsov and so on. Those who was
the systemic opposition.
They were, yes, or who were irritated by you know, brand new Putin regime and so on. And in this situation, in the situation of two types of unlimited resources, Surkov was at his place. He was perfect in some sense. And now the situation is absolutely different. Putin's regime, and he must blame himself that he or it has, you know, a very limited human resources. Very limited, mm-hmm. because they closed all the social, or almost all the social lifts in several last years, and moreover, more interesting, more important, they don't have unlimited financial resources now.
To say the least.
Yes. And that is very, very important. And one more thing. Maybe it's not such, you know, important feature, but if you noticed, Mikhail Prokhorov was rather active last 2 weeks. He made several statements on political issues. There were several, you know, interviews with him in Russian media. And so he, you know, reappeared again. And don't forget that Surkov was a funeral director for his Prokhorov's party.
Well, you can say that Surkov was the midwife of his party and also the funeral director of his party.
Yes.
So it was Surkov's baby, yeah. And Surkov destroyed it. So No, and the reemergence of Prokhorov is interesting right now, especially given the reemergence of Kudrin this week. And Sean, you had something to say before I move on.
Yeah, there's another point I wanted to make, and that's the position of Putin here. I mean, for most of his rule, we've been used to Putin as kind of the balance. He's mm-hmm. he's the arbiter of two or many groups, however many we can kind of discern. He's balancing these groups. But it seems clear that he's gone more to the shareholder Silovik side in this, and he's allowing them, or he can't restrain them, from carrying out a war against the managers.
This is one of the key questions, and you hit on it. He cannot restrain them, or he's allowing them. This I can't figure out. I'd be curious about what the rest of you think about this, because Mark, you...
I'd be surprised if it was truly that he cannot restrain them. I mean, first of all, I haven't been able to discern any signs of dissatisfaction on his part. Secondly, one thing he has managed to do very effectively is, in the good classic style of the authoritarian leader, maintain multiple sources of coercive, in the broadest sense of the word, power. If he felt that Bastrykin was going too far, then he's got the FSB and so forth. I mean, I think there's no signs that the Bastrykins of this world have any kind of independent power base which would allow them to survive, even if Putin no longer had confidence in them. I'm fully willing to believe that in some ways he almost could be acting in, God knows, it's a parallel that neither of them would like, but enormous Gorbachevian manner at times, in the sense of allowing people with a nod and a wink to feel that they are doing what he would like them to do, but in such a way that he can always turn around and actually dissociate himself from it if things go terribly.
So he's leaving himself plausible deniability if this goes bad.
But I'd be very surprised if it was genuinely that he would think, God, I think it's terrible.
I am shocked that the Siloviki are doing all these bad things, right? No, the Prokhorov thing is interesting because, again, Prokhorov and Kudrin, you tend to look at those two in the same vein. I mean, they're kind of cut from the same cloth economically speaking. They're allies politically. Kudrin resurfaces this week, the same week that Prokhorov resurfaces. And looking at what went on with Surkov this week, let's put this in the whole context, because the Kudrin reemergence seemed to suggest, the speculation in the press was that he might get appointed prime minister. Well, if he gets appointed prime minister, that signals a major change of course, and not in the direction that the Siloviki and the shareholders want it to change. So, Mark, how would you let's connect all these dots if we could? How do you interpret Kudrin's reemergence this week?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because Kudrin performs a variety of functions. On one level, he's a human being who could actually be a very plausible prime minister. But on the other hand, he is also symbolic of precisely this shift away, of a shift of a different sort of power base. But also, I think what we have to remember is that Kudrin is an individual in his own right. I thought it was fascinating when he had this interview in which he was asked about being a prime minister. And I think he showed himself to be a much more bare-knuckle political figure than I had thought in the past.
Yeah, he surprised me.
Because, I mean...
The Voronezh interview you're talking about.
He made it very clear
it
that...
very surprising.
That, firstly, that at the moment he didn't really think it likely. But he had some very distinct policy disagreements with the current government, which at first I wondered if that was an anti-Medvedev. Spike. But I think it's actually more generally about policy...
He and Medvedev don't get along personally.
Well, yeah, quite. But also, he very clearly stated that he was not willing to be a technocratic prime minister. So, I mean, I think it's quite interesting that he definitely has put his cards down, that if he is to be appointed, he will need to be a very different type of prime minister with a different type of government. So, in some ways, I mean, he's making his own ultimatum. So, I think that it's increasingly looking as if a Kudrin prime ministership is, on the one hand, far, far more significant if it happens, but secondly, also far, far less likely.
Yeah, that was my takeaway from that as well. Kirill, you wanted to jump in with something along these lines, yeah?
Yes, I think that if Kudrin, could be or would be appointed as a prime minister in Russia, he will be the most unpopular prime minister in post-Soviet Russian history, because he must introduce a lot of so-called austerity measures in Russian economy, and especially in social life. And for the population, these measures must be much more cruel than the measures of the Medvedev's government, and especially then Putin's government. And this situation has, two sides. Firstly, Putin could, made all this dirty work with the help of Putin's hands, yes, by his hands, not directly, and everyone will blame Kudrin, not Putin. And at the same time, at some point, Putin could just leave Kudrin for all this.
Well, this was supposed to be Medvedev's role, but Medvedev's not playing it.
Because Medvedev didn't succeed in these measures. That is the problem, because Medvedev is absolutely talentless politician and especially prime minister, and he couldn't even to introduce several harsh measures with the total support of Vladimir Putin. Look at all this activity in the educational sphere and by Dmitry Levanov and so on. He can do nothing, just nothing. And that's why maybe Kudrin will be much more useful for Putin than Medvedev now.
Well, I'm glad. Don't be afraid to tell us what you really think. Sean, your thoughts on this, on the Kudrin reemergence?
I mean, yeah. Just real a couple of things. First, I mean, I agree with Kirill. I think he would be incredibly unpopular. In fact, the Nisa Visamaya Gazeta article had this to say from one political analysis: such a prime minister that is Kudrin would not be a presidential election rival to Putin. The country would not vote for him, even if Kudrin was to develop that kind of ambition. So I think that Kudrin could be, as a prime minister, could be a short-term power, but perhaps not a long-term power, at least in terms of Putin. The prime ministership, it's interesting, Medvedev versus a Kudrin. I mean, Medvedev does have a lot of hard things to put forward in terms of social reform, as Kirill says, but that requires a strong prime minister. And Putin or the Siloviki, by undermining Medvedev, he doesn't have the power base to put forward those reforms. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of inner contradiction to that. But I've been trying to think about what role is Kudrin playing here in his sudden reappearance. And of course, I think him reappearing at Putin's call-in show, clearly this is Putin allowing him to have a stage. And it's interesting that he reappears at the time where we see so much fracturedness within the government, within the Kremlin. And I'm wondering if Kudrin plays as a kind of Putin's voice from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
He can say things that Putin can't say or is unwilling to say publicly. And I wonder if he's playing this kind of role. The threat of him coming back as a prime minister, and the fact that it's interesting, as Mark says, that he is his own man. And by saying that he's not willing to be a technical prime minister really presents a problem. Because I wonder if Kudrin also might be Putin's ace in the hole. When things get so out of hand with the Siloviki, he perhaps can put Kudrin as prime minister as a bulwark against their power.
Right, and they oppose this hotly. If you look at the responses from certain figures in United Russia who seem to be reflecting the views of the Siloviki, they were saying, the bad state of the economy is really all Kudrin's fault because he was finance minister all these years. So you did see some pushback from both his speech in Voronezh and his comments that he made in the State Duma's open forum session. You saw some serious pushback. It was couched that United Russia was offended that he was insulted their honor or whatever. But it really, I don't think it was about all that. I think this was about the Siloviki faction pushing back. When I look at all this, I'm reminded of something that a very wise political analyst once told me in Moscow, is that the question in Russia is never whether there's a conspiracy afoot. It's which conspiracy happens to be succeeding at the moment. And you have to looking at this, you have to wonder, because I don't see one overarching direction out of this. I see two sides kind of trying to gain the upper hand. With the Kudrin's reemergence, it seems to be the manager is trying to get there, or the technocratic manager is trying to get there, make their advance. And what's going on with Surikov seems to be not necessarily a counterattack, but also a counter-conspiracy going on the Siloviki side. Would you agree with that, Mark?
Only two conspiracies. I think you're being far
no,
too,
there's no, there's
far,
no,
far too
these are the only two we see right now.
No, I mean, I think there's a danger in assuming that everyone is a representative of a bloc. I mean, it is clear that there is this sort of Silovik shareholder sort of revanche sort of taking place. And also, we have Surikov, who, on one level, he is the arch manager, but also he is an individual. I mean, I think it's worth saying that he is a very distinctive figure in his own right, who has made lots of enemies in his own right, rather than purely on a factual basis.
There's a lot of people owe him, but he's also made a lot of enemies. Yeah.
And likewise, if we look at Kudrin, I mean, I'm not sure that I see him perhaps as sort of Putin's deniable mouthpiece, because I think Putin is shown himself to be very willing to criticize the government on many occasions. And in some ways, I almost feel that likewise Kudrin is now acting in his own right. It could be that what he's doing is trying to get through to his friend or former friend, we don't really know, Putin, give him a last chance, say, look, you really need to change routes. I'm the person who can do that. Or it might even be that he's actually beginning to position himself for a post-Putin future. Mm-hmm. I think we see a lot of that kind of survivalist tactics.
So the political entrepreneurship that we've just discussed in the podcast.
Exactly.
In the past.
But I think in this respect, given that, I mean, I think one of the things she's showing is that whereas, let's face it, Medvedev has long since been broken. Kudrin is making it clear that he is not willing to be broken. In that respect, I almost feel that he's making it untenable for himself to be appointed, because we know that Putin is actually, ironically enough, incredibly risk-averse. He's timid, even if it is a rather sort of brutal and vicious timidity, when it comes to questions to which he doesn't have a pretty good idea of what the right answer is. That's why he depends so much on opinion polling and all these other kinds of things. I mean, precisely, Kudrin is almost making himself all the more politically expensive to appoint. So I think, again, maybe Kudrin has more confidence in Putin than the rest of us do, and that he feels that Putin can actually really make a dramatic shift to a new type of politics. But I find it hard to believe.
Although he knows Putin better than any of us, and maybe better than anybody. They've been friends for a long time. I've said it a million times. He's the only one that allowed to use the familiar T form with him in private among the officials. I see this dance between Putin and Kudrin, and I wrote about it on the blog this week, is very, very fascinating, because they're both clearly using each other and using their friendship. Kudrin is, I think you hit it on the head there, that he is basically trying to nudge his old pal to change his ways. I think he is trying to be the good angel on the shoulder, saying, you know, you need to change this. You're ruining your legacy. You're destroying the country. And Putin, for his part, and he's probably the only one that can get away with that. And then he's also very publicly kind of nudging him as well. He's saying other things in private, and he's speaking in code in public, I think, to Putin. I think the audience of all of this is Putin. Putin's using Kudrin. He's using Kudrin as a boogeyman to scare the government. You better do as I say, or look what I got here. I got this prime minister ready to stick in here.
Which, again, is a very Gorbachevian tactic.
Yeah, it is.
And it didn't work for Gorbachev either.
It didn't work for Gorbachev. We know how that ended, yeah. So this dance is just fascinating. I don't know where it's going, but, you know, events might overtake all of this. Because while the economy is not being reformed, the economy is sliding into recession. And sooner or later, Putin might be in a position where he has to fire Medvedev. And then both Putin and Kudrin have a very important decision to make, right, at that point. Kirill, you wanted to jump in.
Yes, I'd like to follow one thing which has been mentioned by Mark, that maybe in some sense Kudrin is trying to secure his post-Putin's future. If we take this point of view, it could be very interesting perspective to look at all these, you know, latest moves by Kudrin, Surkov, and Prokhorov. What if they are just trying to secure their post-Putin future? What if they're trying to seek support for their, you know, after Putin political career? In this case, Kudrin is, you know, trying to find some support from, you know, liberal part of society and especially from business. Prokhorov just trying to re-emerge and to remind the society about his very existence. And it's very interesting that Surkov came to Chechnya.
Yeah, no, those photos are interesting.
Yes, and maybe in this context, from this perspective, maybe this is Kadyrov himself is his, you know, most powerful resource.
And Kadyrov is a very powerful figure, yes, that we often ignore in all of, yes, our Kremlinology because he's sitting down there in Grozny, but Kadyrov is a, yes, player. And sort of appearing with him in those photos and the comments Kadyrov made afterwards where he was saying, this person is still part of Putin's team. He's valuable to the state in any capacity. And I have my confidence in him. That was a signal, too. There's a lot of talking in code going on. Or Sean, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, if this is the case, that people are jockeying for their post-Putin lives, and when that will be, who knows. But let's say that this is happening. It really shows how fractious and how splintered the elite is. Because now they're not looking at right the present, and they're not really even looking at tomorrow. They're looking at years beyond. Mm-hmm. And what is happening in this process? Well, they're kind of looking at themselves rather than actually governing the country. I mean, the political situation now is in complete stasis. The economy is going down the tubes slowly, but it's going down. You have cadre problems, which they still, I think Putin's government has still yet to put forward a workable cadre policy to bring to kind of scoop up young talent and bring them in. In fact, by their actions over the last year, they seem to be alienating whatever talent they might incorporate in. They're not dealing with social policy. They're not trying to institute the reforms that they want to save the budget. I mean, there's talk of whether they should open up the reserve fund to keep on putting money into the social programs. So all of this is, and this is, I think, a characteristic of how, at least my understanding of the deep state. When the deep state looks within itself and concentrates on the rivalries within it, the country is kind of left floating on the sea, and it's aimless. And I think Pavlovsky gave an interview to Sloan. I think, I don't know if that's the one you're referring to, Kirill.
But yes. Yeah. Two of them, interview to Sloan and an article in Politruv, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, he suggested that, you know, the situation now that Putin's government is completely aimless. It has no vision for, not, forget about the future. It
tomorrow.
Has no vision for today. For today, right. It seems.
Right. No, this, and I would add, Sean, to your analysis, which I think is spot on, that the that you have a society that's getting very restive amid all of this, and this accentuates Mark's point that we have to look at these people maybe now as individuals and political entrepreneurs in their own right, rather than representatives of different power blocks and factions in the elite. Kirill, I see you want to jump in. I wanted Mark, because basically Kirill was responding to something Mark said. Is this, what do you think about this, that we're looking, that everybody's looking past Putin already? Do you think that's...
I think so. I think that obviously no one is quite sort of ruling him out now, but I think there is that sense that in some ways he is no longer salvageable, that the gamble that was the castling has failed. It might not be today, it might not be tomorrow, but in some ways almost because what's the point in expending political capital to get on within the Putin system if in fact the Putin system may well not last long, and if he himself doesn't seem to have any great vigour or vision? And I think in that respect, I mean, I want to sort of pick up on the point that Sean made, which I think was spot on about the extent to which when the deep state is busy fighting for itself, it's not doing anything for the country. And almost as a metaphor, you know, at the moment we have these investigations of Skolkova, which obviously is sort of in part simply to nail Surkov, but also in part they clearly at the moment Skolkova is a target. Whereas if you compare that with investigations over Sochi, which I think it's fair to say that there is a vast amount of corruption and embezzlement, much greater than Skolkova. In some ways, because Skolkova represents one particular model for Russia. It's about the technological and economic and therefore political and social recreation of Russia as a high-tech
diversifying
model,
away precisely. From commodities.
Whereas Sochi is your classic, it's about spectacle, it's about prestige national projects that really do nothing of any value, but except sort of, you know, provide bread and circuses almost literally. And it's quite interesting, therefore, you know, of the two projects, which one of them is currently having the screws applied to it and which one is clearly still being featherbedded?
Right. No, you're right. And I would add that the investigations that have gone into Sochi have all been aimed at getting people Medvedev put in place there out and getting Putin people in. Kirill, you're dying to jump in here, so the mic is yours.
Yes, I'm nearly dying. So just two quick remarks, first of all. I think all these people, Prokhorov, Surkov and Kudrin, they're thinking about their own, you know, political future, not because they think really that today Putin's regime is doomed. No, they just cannot change the things just today. And if you can't change, you know, the things and the situation today, it's a psychological thing. You begin to think about tomorrow. That's why they are trying to secure their tomorrow. That's because they cannot change anything now. That is my first point. Second point is that it's very interesting that this recent situation inside Kremlin is, I can describe it, is like Putin is trying to deal with the results of Surkov era, Skolkova, all these things. That is the result of all this attempt of by Surkov to, you know, to invent official liberal high-tech Russia. And he failed. And that's why Gleb Pavlovsky told about this failure in this interview to Sloan, that Surkov tried to invent a new language in which he could, the power of the elite or Kremlin could speak with the society and with the outer world, and he failed. And several things of this failure which Putin is dealing with, they are Skolkova, they are all this, you know, reforms in the military sphere, the reforms in education, and so on. So we have the result of, you know, mixing two failures, of the failure of Surkov's era and the failure of today's, you know, absolutely aimless government of Dmitry Medvedev.
Sean.
Yeah, I just wanted to briefly come back to the question of Putin's place and whether he can't rein them in or he won't. Now, if all of these, where we've gotten in our discussion, if we're thinking about these people as political entrepreneurs thinking about their post-Putin future, then that puts Putin as a very weak figure in the sense that he won't be able to rein them in because they're too busy working for their own political mm-hmm. lives as individuals or with their own kind of circles. And therefore, I think maybe we should kind of edit or revise our analysis and think about perhaps Putin has lost control.
Yeah, no, I said this earlier, I think this is one of the key, there is never one key question in Russia, just like there's never one conspiracy. But this is one of the key questions right now. Has Putin lost control? And this returns me to the thing I wanted to discuss before we go to the second half. And that is the Siloviki appear to be going for broke. I mean, because it's not just Kudrin and Prokhorov and Surkov who are thinking about the post-Putin era. The Siloviki are the strongest of the bunch here, and they are probably thinking about the post-Putin era as well. And it leads to the question, are the Siloviki going for broke? And what are the Siloviki after post-Putin? Mark, you're the Siloviki expert.
Well, I mean, the Siloviki, it's interesting because in some ways I think they have a two-track approach. On one level, the status quo works for them. Yes, they'd like to tweak things. Yes, they have disagreements amongst themselves. But actually, high Putinism, shall we say, worked for them. So I think sort of, in a way, they have option A, which is actually, as they would see it, fix the situation. You know, get the protesters broken, make sure that the administrative team that you bring in realise that that's all they are. They're just the managers and so forth. They know their place. You know, bring things back to a largely mythologised golden era of Putinism, which is ridiculously unrealistic because times change, and not least because actually Putinism worked because it was at a time of great fortune, not least with hydrocarbon prices. But nonetheless, you know, everyone likes to deceive themselves. Mm-hmm. So track A is fix the current situation. Track B, which is exactly the dangerous one, which is, okay, well, if this doesn't work, what do we do? I mean, the answer is obviously we'd have to get rid of Putin, or Putin would have to go one way or the other. And then what happens then? And I think this is, again, this is the area where questions of control become important. I mean, I still feel that Putin still has the power to sack anyone he wants. In that respect, he is powerful. But the point is, he can't use that weapon too often, or he becomes regarded as dangerous to the people on whom he needs to rely. And that's the point where they decide that, you know, he needs to go. So, you know, again, for someone who actually doesn't like taking risks and is not confrontational when he's not in a really strong position, I think this is why sort of Putin is almost hoping that a lot of these figures like Bastrykin either succeed or destroy themselves and their credibility. But I think, therefore, sort of going back to what does this sort of track B look like for the Siloviki, it's positioning themselves so that they will be the kingmakers. I don't really see many of them, Ivanov is the obvious exception, possibly Rogozin, who might actually have presidential ambitions themselves. You know, the Sechins of this world, they don't want to be presidents. They don't want to be meeting foreign dignitaries. No. They just want to be powerful and rich and live with impunity. So really, they want to make sure that they're going to be in the position to pick the next guy rather than be the next guy.
Right, right. No, and Ivanov is certainly one who has ambitions to the presidency. He can win the internal battle. I'm not sure he can present himself in the public as a viable alternative.
To be honest, I think the problem with Ivanov is precisely because he's too ambitious.
Yeah, nobody trusts him.
Yeah, nobody trusts him, and no one would regard him as a suitable cipher. They're going to want someone who will rule for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll change topics and look at the ongoing spy games between Moscow and Washington. I would like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. And joining us in London is co-host Kirill Coburn of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online portal Politru. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Kirill, you no doubt recognize that music.
Absolutely. So golden era of Soviet, you know, propaganda movies.
Yes. It's a cartoon called Spy's Passion. Shortly after Russia announced that it had detained American diplomat, Ryan Fogel for allegedly spying, reports surfaced that Moscow had also expelled a former senior U.S. official from the country weeks earlier. Thomas Firestone had worked as a representative of the United States Justice Department at the embassy. He had been working as a lawyer in Russia and had extensive contacts in the Russian government. He was detained at Sheremetyevo Airport while returning to the country, held for 16 hours, declared persona non grata, and expelled. The New York Times reported that in March, Firestone had been approached by Russian intelligence, which tried to enlist him as a spy. According to the report, Firestone turned them down and suggests that maybe that was the reason for his expulsion. Mark, I need to apologize to you personally here. Kirill, Sean, and I talked about spies last week without you, and I hope you're not offended.
I feel soiled by the way.
I'll try to make it up to you now. What do you make of all this? Is the espionage game between Russia and the U.S. picking up steam, or is something else going on here? How do you take the Fogel and the Firestein thing together? What do you see going on?
I think there's two parallel things going on that sort of almost happen to have intersected at this point. Yes, there's the espionage or counter-espionage kind of campaign going on, which is, for a variety of reasons, it's about internal politics as the Federal Security Service asserts its own importance. It's also about taking advantage of an opportunity when it's presented by a presumed young CIA officer. But in some ways, for me, the Firestone case is more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, because it wasn't sort of turned into a propaganda circus. It's been a while. And secondly, in terms of what it actually says, I think it is about the wider process in which Russia is trying, or the Russian government is trying to insulate itself from foreign cosmopolitan influences. Of course, you know that foreign countries are going to spy on Russia, just as Russia spies on foreign countries. It's just part of the game of modern statecraft. And sometimes you'll quietly expel spies, and sometimes you'll make a splash, depending on what the political needs of the moment are. But when we put the Firestone case next to the whole, you know, foreign agents saga, next to all kinds of other efforts to basically try and begin to insulate Russia from the outside world, even, you know, trying to prevent officials and so forth from having their money abroad, I think it says something about the current paranoid, inward-looking, almost xenophobic turn that we're seeing within Russia. And particularly that sense that the West and America in particular is antithetical to the current power structure, which again is a terribly, terribly Soviet attitude, which for a while I think had receded. There was a lot of rhetorical conflict with America, but I don't think there was that sense of a real clash of civilizations. Mm-hmm. That seems to be coming back now.
Yeah, and also, correct me if I'm wrong, but in his capacity as a private lawyer in Russia, Firestone was advising the government on legal reform, right?
Is that... Yeah, and in fact, he was awarded, while he was still at the U.S. Embassy, the Anti-Monopoly Commission,
mm-hmm.
Gave him an award for cooperative assistance. But again, I think, you know, if you think about the areas that Tom Firestone was working on, he was particularly, he was a trenchant critic of the practice of raiding, the use of the courts to basically steal assets and companies, and had done probably more than anyone else to publicize it within both, you know, policy and academic and other circles. He was also an expert in corruption legislation, anti-corruption legislation, and particularly the U.S. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Mm-hmm. So the kind of work he was doing there, again, if we want to sort of pull it back to the issues we were talking about before, they actually fit in very much with this sort of Sokovian Medvedev approach of trying to create a new kind of Russia that's much more law-based and legalistic, which can still be strong and everything else. And by expelling him, it's a blow for the old style of Russia where might makes right.
Right. So this actually does fit into our discussion we had earlier, where now as you were talking, I was thinking this, you know, he's not that this was his intention, but he was kind of an advisor to the managerial side of the elite, the technocratic side of the elite,
right.
Not explicitly, but de facto. Sean, you want to jump in? You have anything to say about this whole case?
Yeah. Yeah, I do think that there is certainly a connection, as Mark says, to this kind of in building a wall around Russia and trying to guard it from cosmopolitan influence. I like your use of the term. And expelling him, someone who worked on the legalistic side and tried to deal with raiding and issues of corruption, is interesting in today's context, because if you try to seal off or prevent Western kind of poking into Russia's domestic business, then you try to seal off potential rivals within Russia from linking up with those Western groups, and that just doesn't just go for the opposition. which they, of course, they're trying to link, trying their best to link to foreign capital funding their activities. But I think it also tried to close off the potential of people like within the elite who might try to hook up with Western interests, not in any nefarious way, but at least use those connections to try to pressure the more conservative sides, conservative side of Russian, the Russian elite.
Kirill?
I don't know anything about, the very issue or the very matter of the spy games, because I'm not a specialist in this, field of human activity.
Neither, but Mark's enough expert for all of us.
Yes. But we can imagine or just, even analyze how Putin's regime could or would use all the situation and how it didn't use this spy incident for his own purposes. For instance, in the Soviet times when such things happened, of course, that was, Soviet elite or Kremlin included all these cases in their into their, propaganda tools against the West. Yes, and that was very, happy for them to find some American or British or German spy and then to explain everything to Soviet people that West is just trying to destabilize or to steal some secrets from Soviet society, but we are right because we are Soviet people and we are right because we have Soviet ideology, we are right because we are constructing or moving to communism. And that was very important. That was a part of ideological war. Now, there is no any, ideological foundation for this, propaganda and so on. Of course, Kremlin trying to reestablish a sort of anti-Western sentiments and propaganda for its, trying to reach its own aims. But Kremlin, Putin, doesn't have its own ideology. He cannot put something against their ideas of Western way of life, liberal way of life, democratic values, and especially market values. They're quite popular in Russian society. I'm not speaking about, some liberal values, especially after last sociological polls in Russia about, gay rights and so on. But actually, Russian society is much more pro-Western than it seems to Kremlin. And it couldn't use these tools in their own, in their own propaganda, especially trying to fight with opposition and so on. That's why Kremlin couldn't use all these spy cases very successfully. And that's very important. I didn't notice any substantial attempts to include this spy incident with American diplomats into some, greater frames, in some, right, tendency, try to use it in on the, in the attacks on NGOs or something, or some opposition forces and so on. It's just an isolated incident, and that's all. And well,
it's interesting to watching Russian television and the denouncing of the of America in the wake of the Fogel case, and I just found it really telling that TV they cut to an advertisement for a Hollywood movie right after that. I also think, going back to the Firestone case, I mean, the mirror imaging of the Fogel and the Firestone case are interesting, because here in the Fogel case, you had an American accused of spying who was expelled with a big song and dance and propaganda show. The Firestone case, the Russians did it very quietly, but this is a case where they tried to recruit or tried to compromise an American that they wanted to get rid of in one way or the other. So it's all, and it was done very quietly. It only emerged weeks later, in news reports. Now before we wrap up, the last thing I want to put this in the context of is this Siloviki going for broke meme that we talked about in the first half, because they are clearly going for broke domestically and in the foreign sphere. What are the implications of this? If the implications are the isolation of Russia, no? Mark?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is, though, and here Kirill is spot on about the lack of an ideological base for this. On the one hand, the Siloviki, They basically want to have their playpen free of foreign influence. But their wealth depends on their contacts with international markets. They cannot turn Russia into a sort of a massive Eurasian North Korea and do anything other than immiserate themselves and lose all those wonderful opportunities. And this is why they hated the Magnitsky Bill, or you know, the whole notion of that. They want to be able to travel. They want to be able to have agreeable pied-à-terre around the world and such like. So, I mean, I think that the point of view from the Siloviki's point of view is very much it's an instrumentalist point of view. They don't actually want to secede from the rest of the world. They can't afford to, and it's not in their interests. What they want to do is to create this illusion that Russia is beleaguered by often unspecified foreign forces, which necessitate a pulling together. And I think it's going to fail. And I think in the process, Russia will continue to be regarded as this sort of problem child within the international community. And the Siloviki are then going to be faced with it. Either they accept that times have changed, or they're going to have to go more extreme. And this is where, I mean, in some ways, I think you talk about them going for broke. I don't think they're quite there yet, because I think it could be far, far scarier. You know, we haven't yet got doctors' plots and the like, if you're going to sort of start playing for these sorts of things. No. But nonetheless, one couldn't rule it out. You know, apartment bombs may not be happening again, but who knows what kind of things could happen.
Yeah, we've been down this road before, and it almost, you know, the often overused cliche of history repeats itself as tragedy and then farce. I'm wondering which we're in, because this has happened so many times that I don't know how many degrees of farce or tragedy we're in now. Sean, last word to you before we wrap up.
I mean, yeah, just to kind of pull Mark and Kirill's statements together, I mean, yeah, Mark is right. They can't afford it, right? They need the international capital. They need the international capital flows to maintain their lifestyles. But also from what Kirill said, they can't use it. It the foreign plots, because they don't have an ideology, they can't really create a consolidated Russia, the Russian public against the foreign enemy from outside who might have contacts with the enemy inside. This has major, major limits on both of those fronts. And I think Kirill is right. This is why this is a blip, but it's not, it didn't last very long. Hmm.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll wrap up, because that is unfortunately all we have time for today. I would like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from London has been Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online portal Politru. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant and very patient producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also add that Pavel found that really cool audio that we used in the beginning of the second segment and the first segment, for that matter. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.